Alrighty, good morning everybody. This is Bio-231 and it's March 23rd and I got to tell you what's on the test. Okay. When is the test, by the way? Wednesday. Yeah, Wednesday. Not today. Somebody thought it was today. But it's Wednesday. And let's see, what chapters is it on? Yeah, it's not very many chapters, but muscle's kind of a long chapter, so that's okay. 10, 11, and 12. Chapters 10, 11, and 12. That's skeletal muscles, that's muscles of the body, and then 12 is fundamentals of the nervous system, nervous tissue. Okay. And I got a feeling it might have 100 questions on there, if I can do that, because it takes me a whole lot less time to grade the tests if it's just 100 questions, and I don't have to calculate a percentage. But we'll see about that. Maybe not. Pay attention during the test as to how many questions there are on the actual test so you don't forget to flip to the back page. I always try to look, but sometimes I don't catch a student that doesn't work the last questions. All right, so we're going to finish up central nervous system today and maybe move on to peripheral nervous system in lecture, but does anybody have any questions? No? Okay. So we were talking about the brain, different lobes of the brain last time, and I think we went over all the major functions of the different lobes, like, for instance, the occipital lobe. What's the function of the occipital lobe? And, of course, you should know where the occipital lobe is. Where is that occipital lobe? By the occipital bone. That's right. All right, and the occipital lobe is responsible for what kind of function? It's for vision. Yeah. What about the parietal lobe?
Here?
Yeah, parietal lobe. The parietal lobe is anterior, or even we might call it rostral to the occipital lobe. What's the function of the parietal lobe? Okay. Parietal lobe contains the primary somatosensory cortex or sensory cortex. So where you have sensations on the surface of your body, they go to the parietal lobe for your appreciation, for your conscious appreciation of those different senses. And those would be like what? Temperature, pain, vibration, various kinds of touch, deep pressure. And if we look at the surface of the brain, all right, here we see occipital lobe. And then this is the, what lobe is this right here? This is the parietal lobe. All right, and what separates the parietal lobe from the frontal lobe? That's going to be the central sulcus. So where's the central sulcus? Right here. All right, don't forget, what is a sulcus? It's an invagination of the surface of the brain. It's a depression because the cortex is folded, right? And the folds are really convolutions, and the depression is what we call a sulcus. What do we call the raised area of a convolution? That's a gyrus, right? And so the central sulcus separates the frontal lobe from the parietal lobe. And this first gyrus, just posterior to the central sulcus, otherwise known as what? The post-central gyrus, right? Because it's right behind the central sulcus. This is the somatosensory cortex of the brain, and this is where you have appreciation for everything that happens on the surface of your body. All right, and if we go anterior to the central sulcus, there's another gyrus right here. That's not the pulse central gyrus. Guess what gyrus that is? That is the precentral gyrus, because it's in front of the central sulcus, and that is the primary motor cortex of the brain. All right, so if you're going to move a part of your body, this is the part of the brain that one uses to initiate those movements, the primary motor cortex. And they match up pretty much. So for instance, right in this area here, if this area was going to manipulate your fingers, if that's the area that was going to have to undergo electrical activity to move your fingers, right on the other side of the central sulcus in this region here, all right, this would give you appreciation for sensation on your fingers. So the surface of your brain maps out very nicely in a one-to-one correspondence with the surface of your body. Okay. I'll show you a map of that in just a second. Let's finish up with that temporal lobe. What's the function of the temporal lobe? That's for for that's the primary auditory cortex. That's where you have the appreciation of sound. All right, so sound comes into this region right here, and then it's processed with other information because maybe it's music or maybe it's language or something. So that information then is passed on to association areas for you to make more and more and more sense out of what you're hearing. Same thing for the visual cortex. This is the primary visual cortex. So this is where you might see certain patterns of black and white and maybe colors. And then that information is passed on to some higher centers of the brain because maybe that black and white pattern is maybe a language, right? And so your brain then makes sense of those patterns of black and white. And then that information is passed on to even further higher centers of the brain because now maybe it's just not a letter, but maybe it's a word or a paragraph, or it has some meaning or connotation. So the association areas make sense of the things that you see in very simple kinds of ways. Okay, the other thing about the frontal cortex right over here, the prefrontal cortex is the one way in the front. This is the part of the brain that gives you decision making and gives you your personality. This is where impulsiveness kind of comes from. Some people are more impulsive than others. Other people like to think about their situation a little bit more before making a decision. And so that's the prefrontal cortex. This also gives you social skills and how to interact in social situations by looking at everything that's going on around you. Question? Where? In the prefrontal cortex. So the very anterior part of the frontal lobe. Okay? Yeah, right here. All right, so that kind of tells us something about the brain in terms of the cortex. And what kind of tissue is on the cortex of the brain? Is it gray matter or a white matter? Okay, you know what? Right on the cortex, it's gray matter. It's nerve cell bodies and dendrites. That's where signal processing takes place, in gray matter. All right? Yeah, it's without myelin. It's nerve cell bodies and dendrites. That's where the network is formed. That's where network is made, in gray matter. Tracks are just cables. Tracks are just myelinated axons that are going someplace. So they just transmit information. But axons don't necessarily make connections or share information. They just take information long distances within the central nervous system.
So then what would they manage if that's the one that goes to the cervical?
Okay, I'm not quite sure, but for instance, think of gray matter as being like the central processing unit in the computer, and white matter is just a cable that's connecting up different peripheral units. Okay, that's maybe a good way to think about the difference between gray matter and white matter. White matter is just a cable carrying information from one place to another. All right, so don't forget, there is, of course, very important information. For instance, if somebody is communicating with you, right, they might be speaking a language, but what else do you use in your senses to figure out what somebody is saying?
Language.
Yeah, you correlate visual information, maybe the way that they're moving their hands, all right, or the way that they're saying something, or the expression on their face, right? So you use visual information. So in order to completely understand what somebody's saying, you have to use what? Both the occipital lobe, the visual cortex, as well as the auditory cortex, right, for things to make sense to you. And I just thought of an example, but it's really kind of, it's a nasty example. You can't hold me accountable for it, but it's okay. I can show you because it won't go on the tape. Okay? I could say, oh, I'm happy to see you. Okay? So you use what? Both your visual information and auditory information to come up with connotation, right? Nuance. Okay. Okay. So where are those? Those are what carried out in the association areas of the brain. Okay. All right. So in terms of white matter of the brain, so don't forget, these are axons that are carrying information between different parts of the brain. Think of them as being cables. It's not for processing information. It's for ways that information can be shared between different areas. All right, so that's white matter. So what's a classical definition of white matter then? Yeah, cables, but in terms of anatomy, a little bit more proper anatomical term. Myelinated axons that are going someplace, right? So they're insulated axons. We got three different kinds. We got commissural fibers, we have association fibers, and projection fibers. Commissural fibers, and so these are tracks. Commissural fibers do what? They interconnect corresponding areas of gray matter between the right and left hemisphere. So they go from one side of your brain to the other. So they're carrying left-right traffic. All right. Projection fibers are tracts that are carrying information from the spinal cord up to the brain, for instance, or information from your brain down to your spinal cord. All right, so projection has what, an inferior, posterior kind of connection going up and down. And can you see that's different than right and left associations? Yeah, absolutely. All right. So as a matter of fact, tracts that are ascending, what do we call ascending tracts? Yeah, I think afferent or sensory. And if they're descending tracts, they're going to be? Yeah, they're going to be, descending is going to be efferent or motor tracts. All right, so those would be projection fibers. And then association fibers are, yeah. Well, if they're ascending, it's sensory, okay, or afferent. If they're descending tracts, it could be one of the two kinds. It could be a descending tract. And if it's a descending tract, then it's going to be an efferent or motor. Yeah, motor tract. Okay, because for instance, if somebody puts an ice cube on your earlobe, right, that information goes into your brain, but there's no really good reason why that sense of cold has to be appreciated by your kneecap, right? So that sensory information goes to your brain where it's integrated. That information doesn't need to go to some other part of your body, right? Until it's what? Until it's appreciated by your brain, and then your brain makes a decision what to do with that sense, like maybe move your head away from it or something, okay? Okay, the last kind, association fibers, interconnects gray areas within the same hemisphere. So maybe sound in the right temporal lobe with an area for appreciation of what that sound means, maybe language in the right parietal lobe. But again, it doesn't go right or left, doesn't go up and down. It just stays within the same hemisphere. It could go anterior, posterior. So that's what we call a projection fiber. So what do these things kind of look like? So, okay, here we go. Here's a nice picture of it. Now, I don't know. Maybe you can you see different kinds of colors right here? All right, so projection fibers. They look sort of blue to me. Green, okay. Well, all right, so right where I have the cursor right now. Okay. Purple. Yeah, that's blue. That's blue to me. So here we see fibers that are moving from this area of the brain. Can anybody tell me about what area of the brain this sort of looks like? Could be thalamus, but you know what? It might be a little bit above that. It's probably the thalamus. And so there are projection fibers that go to the thalamus and then project fibers to the corresponding proper part of the cerebral cortex. So if signals are going from the thalamus to the cerebral cortex, what kind of projection fiber is that? Is that going to be afferent or efferent? Afferent or efferent? I heard the right answer. But since they're going up, it's sensory information, so they are afferent projection fibers, right? And sometimes we call this like the corona radiata, right? Because it kind of looks like a starburst, a bunch of light rays leaving the sun. Okay. And then these tracts that we can see going between different gray areas in the same hemisphere. What do we call these kinds of fibers? These are? Okay, those are what we call association fibers. That's how your mind puts together and integrates information and shares different kinds of information. Like what? Like auditory and visual information. My last demonstration didn't go over very well, so I don't think I'll do it again. Okay, but that's how information gets integrated together with what? Association fibers. And then lastly, we have fibers that go between the right and left hemispheres. And there is a structure, and those fibers aren't shown very clearly. I only see them as dots. Why do I only see them as a dot on this diagram? Because they're going in and out of the image, out of the plane of this image. So when we cut it, right, we only see those nerve fibers in cross-section. So if it's a long nerve fiber and we cut it, we only see, what, a little dot. So these fibers are going between the right and left cerebral hemispheres. And then you should probably know the name of this structure that's kind of outlined right here. Sort of, does it kind of look gray? It looks a little shaded, but all those little dots are making an outline of the corpus callosum. Right? So for instance, if somebody has a lesion in this part of the brain, then one side of their brain won't know what the other side is appreciating or thinking. And that produces some really strange kind of anomalies because, for instance, language skills are on one side of the brain, mathematical skills are on the other side. So you might show somebody a couple of numbers, like 1 and 2, and their brain can see the numbers 1 and 2. And if you ask them, what numbers do you see? They'll say, oh, 1 and 2. And then you could ask them, well, what's the sum of those numbers? And they'll go, I don't know. What would be a good answer? Would be 3. But a person that can't share that information between their cerebral hemispheres won't know how to add those numbers together and won't know what the answer is to that really simple question because of a lesion in these commissural tracts that are connecting different parts of the brain. Okay, so that's a corpus callosum right there. All right, so here we see some other, illustration of different kinds of tracts, like ascending and descending tracts. These would be projection fibers, right? And here we see, where's the thalamus at? Where's the thalamus? Right here. All right. What's the function of the thalamus? The function of the thalamus. That is a relay station for sensory fibers. They have to stop in the thalamus before they reach the cerebral cortex. So the thalamus tells action potentials or electrical activity, sensory electrical activity, where to go in the cerebral cortex. All right, so do you see any of these tracts stopping in the thalamus?
Yeah.
They kind of look like, well, I tell you what, let's look at these three right here. Let me really zoom in. All right, you see these three fibers right here, 1, 2, 3? Here's the thalamus. Do you see them stop at the thalamus at all? No, they're just bypassing the thalamus. So a question I could ask you is this an afferent tract or an efferent tract? Okay, because if it is an afferent or sensory tract, these signals have to do what? They have to go to the thalamus where they synapse and then proceed to the cerebral cortex. All right, so since these are bypassing, and you can you tell this is white matter right here? Because this is all white looking, and this is gray matter right here. All right, so these tracts are going through this area between the thalamus and the basal nuclei. This is sometimes what we call the internal capsule, and these are all motor tracts that are descending from the brain because they're not. You can see that they're not stopping in the thalamus to be relayed to the cerebral cortex. All right, those projection fibers. Now, what kind of fibers are these right here? What are these fibers right here? These are commissural fibers because they're going between the right and left hemispheres, right? So what would be the name of this structure right here, right on midline? That's the corpus callosum. Right, the corpus callosum. And you can see the internal capsule, the thalamus, and the basal nuclei. All right, look what else we can see. What can you tell me about these tracts right here? They cross over. We are right in the medulla, right at the, there's some like triangular columns right here that we call the pyramids. And you can see them crisscross over in a real brain if it's dissected really nicely. We call that decussation of the pyramids. That's where signals cross over, right on the anterior part of the medulla. All right. So you're left side of your brain is controlling the, what side of your body? Left side of your brain is controlling the right side of your body. Yeah, all right, but you can see commissural fibers, and I don't see any association fibers in here anywhere, but also projection fibers. Okay. The cerebellum, where's that cerebellum at? All right, so, don't see it there. Here's the cerebellum. All right, so that's not a lobe of the cerebrum, that's a part of the brain all by itself. And it's responsible for maintaining balance while you're performing some kind of motor activity. And as you practice that motor activity more and more and more, the cerebellum learns how to produce that kind of motor activity so that you do it in a nice coordinated fashion. And a good example of that would just be a very simple act that we all take for granted right now, and that would be walking. Right, so walking, you throw your weight way out in front of you and you're just a split second away from just smashing your whole face right into the ground. But what saves you? You move your other foot in front of you and it catches you, and we've all learned how to do that really amazingly in a graceful way. Okay, but we're all just a split second from completely crashing. And that's the job of the cerebellum, to maintain all your postural muscles and to move your skeletal muscles. And that works in conjunction with the primary motor cortex right here, because the primary motor cortex is where you make the decision to move part of your body, and then the cerebellum gets involved so that you do it in a coordinated fashion. All right, so let's stimulate different parts of the brain. Let's take an electrode or put a drop of chemical on different parts of the brain, for instance, and let's just say that we stimulate the occipital lobe right here. What's going to happen? Anything? Okay, I'll give you a hint. Something's going to happen. Okay, what would happen if we were to stimulate this part of the brain? You would have some kind of visual experience. Yeah, it might not like a word, but maybe it would be a flash of color or something, or maybe a shape, something of that nature, right? Because that's the function of this part of the occipital lobe. What would happen if we stimulated this part of the temporal lobe? You would have some kind of hearing experience, right? You'd hear something. I don't know if it would be pleasant or not, depending on exactly how it was stimulated. Maybe if we stimulated three nearby regions of the temporal lobe right here, maybe you'd hear a chord, for instance, and that probably would be an okay kind of experience. All right, what would happen if we stimulated this part of the cerebral cortex? What would happen? Okay, first tell me, what lobe is that? Okay, you know what? I want to correct your impression on that. Okay, that's actually, where's the central sulcus? Is the central sulcus posterior or anterior to where I have the cursor? Yeah, the central sulcus is posterior to where I have the cursor. So where I have the cursor is what? Anterior to the central sulcus. So what lobe is that? That's the frontal lobe. All right, and you should know the name of that gyrus right there. That is the precentral gyrus. What's the function of the precentral gyrus? That's where you initiate motor activity in your body. That's the primary motor cortex. Now, how is it that that's kind of easy for most people to remember? What's a good analogy maybe you could use to remember that the frontal lobe is the motor cortex? Motor meaning what? It makes something move in your body when it goes into electrical activity. Think about your car. Where do you have the motor? Most people have it in the front, right? So that's a good way to remember frontal lobe is what for motor activity. Does anybody have their motor of their car right smack in the middle of their car? No? Okay, that's too bad. We could be friends if you had a motor right smack in the middle of your car, right? Only really, really expensive cars have such things. Most motors are in the front. Of course, there's a few with motors in the back. But just remember, the precentral gyrus is for motor. So if we were to stimulate where the cursor is right now in that precentral gyrus, what would happen? Some part of your body would move. Yeah, some muscles would contract someplace. All right, and now instead of stimulating the precentral gyrus, let's stimulate the postcentral gyrus. All right, then what's going to happen? What area of the brain is that? That's the somatosensory cortex. That's your primary sensory cortex. You would have some kind of sensation corresponding to some surface on your body, some area on your body. Yeah. Yeah, because that central sulcus is the line of demarcation between the frontal lobe and the parietal lobe. And there's no such nice designation between the occipital lobe and parietal lobe.
How do they make that division?
How do they make that? Well, you'll have to know a little bit more neuroanatomy, but I don't want to get into it in this class. Okay? Okay. The central sulcus is good enough for us because it's easy to see. Now, when you look at a sheep brain, you won't be able to find it. It's not delineated so nicely. Maybe if you look at the real brain that we have in lab, it still might be a little bit confusing to find it. All right, but on this illustration, of course, we can make the central sulcus perfectly. Right, so it's easy to see on illustrations. Yeah. Oh, of course. Maybe it's probably in lab 2C right now. It's in a jar. All right, but don't open up the jar and take that brain out, because it'll just turn to pudding, because it's very mushy. Keep it inside the jar. Okay, but the sheep brains you can play, mess around with as much as you want to. All right, and I think maybe you're starting to do sheep brains this week.
Yeah,
I would think so.
Eyes.
Oh, eyes are good. Yeah, eyeball dissections are fun too. Okay, brains. Usually I cover eyeballs and brains in the same lab. Depends on how it's, I forget how it's set up for you guys. Okay. Spinal cord. So let's go talk about the spinal cord. So the spinal cord starts, where does the spinal cord start exactly? Right at the foramen magnum, right at the occipital bone, at the foramen magnum in the occipital bone. And so anything below the foramen magnum is spinal cord. And again, in the spinal cord, I tell you what, spinal cord, is that central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? It is still central nervous system. It's still the central nervous system. And remember, there's two kinds of matter in your brain. What were the two kinds of matter? Gray and white. So the spinal cord has gray matter and white matter as well. In the brain, where is the gray matter located at? Okay, but it's in all lobes. Gray matter is in all lobes. But what part of the lobes we find gray matter? Mostly it's on the surface of the brain. What do we call the surface of the brain? The cerebral. Yeah, the cortex. Just like what's the superficial part of a bone called? That's the cortex of a bone. Right? So the superficial part of your brain is called the cerebral cortex. That's gray matter. And the white matter is deep, because that's where tracts are, like the internal capsule, like the corpus callosum. Right? You might have certain nuclei inside the brain, like the basal nuclei that are gray, but most of the matter deep inside the brain, I would say, consider it tracts or white matter. So there's a little distinction in the spinal cord. It goes the opposite way in the spinal cord. So let me show you a picture of the spinal cord. Okay, spinal cord is... there's a lot of stuff we don't have to look at in here. All right, here's spinal cord. Let's look at this picture right here. So here is gray matter, and here is white matter. So white matter in the spinal cord is superficial, and gray matter is what? Deep. So what kind of parts of a neuron, let me zoom right in, would you find right here?
That
cell bodies and dendrites, right? That's gray matter, and it's not myelinated. And in this part of the spinal cord, you would find what? Myelinated axons. They're either ascending or descending, depending on if they're a sensory tract or a motor tract. Okay? All right, so this is what we call the gray matter of the spinal cord, and it kind of looks like a butterfly or an H. And there is even a connection between the two areas of gray matter. This is what we call the gray commissure, because it's gray matter. Commissure means what? This is a way for signals to get from one side of the spinal cord to the other. because in the white matter, signals are primarily doing what? They're going either up or down. They're not going from right or left. So through the gray commissure, they go right or left. Okay, so that's a big difference between the brain and the spinal cord. All right, the spinal cord has pathways where signals can either enter or leave the central nervous system. So if it's a sensory pathway, which way are signals going? If it's sensory, which way are signals going? They're going into the spinal cord. Right, so they're going from receptors into the spinal cord if it's sensory. If they're motor, they're doing what? They're leaving the spinal cord, going out to your body somehow, right? That's a motor signal. All right, and so those pathways where signals can either enter or leave the spinal cord are what we call roots. And one is called the dorsal root and the other is called the ventral root. And here we can see them. So this is the anterior or ventral side of the spinal cord. And this is the posterior or what side? Posterior or dorsal. Right? And so here you can see the two pathways that are taking nerve impulses either into or out of the spinal cord. So here is a root. And all of these little things that come together to form a root, we call these things, take a guess, it's kind of cute. Those are what we call rootlets. These are rootlets. So numerous rootlets come together to form a root. And the same for the dorsal side of the spinal cord. All of these are rootlets, and then this forms the root. And roots are kind of interesting because they are 100% sensory or 100% motor. They're never mixed. So roots are always a one-way street, carrying information one way, not two ways. And you got to know which way is which. All right, so the ventral root right here is the anterior one. The ventral root is the motor root. So if it's a motor root, which way are signals going? Where I have the cursor right here. They're only leaving the central nervous system, leaving the spinal cord in this direction. Now, if it's the dorsal root, what does that mean? So if the ventral root is motor, what about the dorsal root? It's going to be 100% sensory. Every single case, never an exception to that rule. And it's amazing to run into something in anatomy or biology where there's no good exception to the rule. All right, but this is a nice exception. All right, so how is it that I can remember that? A couple different ways. Even if I don't talk about it for 20 years, I can remember which root is which. Okay, and the silly way to remember that, all right, what are the two roots? Dorsal and ventral. All right, and one is sensory. All right, so look at that nice S in sensory. All right, and the other was what? Motor. Look at that nice T in motor. Right, there's a nice T in ventral. There's a nice S in dorsal right here. So that's one way to remember it. But a more sophisticated way of remembering that is, what lobe of the brain is responsible for motor activity? Is it the occipital lobe, parietal lobe? For motor, the primary motor cortex. Yeah, how are you going to remember the motor's in the front? Because you have your motor in your car in the front, right? And the architecture of the spinal cord kind of parallels the architecture of your brain, right? So this ventral root, or what, the anterior root is motor, just like your frontal cortex is motor. And your parietal lobe is sensory. So the dorsal parts of the spinal cord are sensory as well. Just that kind of simple arrangement. So motor and sensory don't cross over, only right and left cross over in the central nervous system. Okay. All right, so once the rootlets come together to form roots, we consider that the peripheral nervous system. And here is a bulge right here. Where's this bulge located? It's in the dorsal root. Yeah, that bulge is in the dorsal root. And guess what's in that bulge? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites of unipolar neurons. What's the function of a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar neuron? It's sensory. So does that make sense with what I was talking about so far? Because the dorsal root is sensory, you have nerve cell bodies, the sensory neurons in there, and a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the peripheral nervous system is called a ganglion. So that's the dorsal root ganglion. And you can always see the dorsal root ganglion on an illustration because of that bulge right there. So you can have thousands and thousands of nerve cell bodies right here in the dorsal root. Okay. So these different areas of gray matter are what we call horns. So this horn right here, guess what we call this area? This is the dorsal or ventral. That's the dorsal horn. Here is the ventral horn. And then here is the lateral horn of the gray matter of the spinal cord. And these have different kinds of cell bodies, depending on the function. All right, so in the ventral root, this is where we have cell bodies of association neurons. And in the dorsal horn right here, this is where we have nerve cell bodies of motor neurons that are going to innervate various muscles in your body. And in the lateral horn right here, we have nerve cell bodies of your autonomic nervous system, which we're going to talk about maybe before spring break. Yeah, probably right before spring break. Okay, autonomic nervous system. Maybe I'll have to look at the scale. I don't want to take time to look at it right now. If not, then right after spring break, we'll talk about autonomic nervous system. Okay. All right, and then when the two roots come together, they form this structure right here. Guess what we call that thing right there? That is a? That's a nerve. Yeah, that's just a spinal nerve because it's coming from the spinal cord. And what could you tell me about the function of this spinal nerve right here? Is it motor or is it sensory or what else could it be? Both. Yeah, I like both. That's really good foresight to see that. We don't say both usually. We say in anatomy, we say mixed. If it's carrying both sensory and motor information, we call it a mixed nerve. That can be a two-way street. Not that a neuron can carry information two ways, but there are what? There are tracts that are, I mean, there are nerve fibers that are carrying information one way and other fibers carrying information the other way. Okay, so that's a spinal nerve. And we're going to talk about these little projections when we get to the autonomic nervous system. Okay. All right, so that's about the two kinds of paths. Let's talk about the gross structure of the spinal cord. It was back up over here. Okay, yeah, there's a baby. I'll talk about that maybe just a little bit. So don't forget, the spinal cord goes from foramen magnum to what? About L2. And then you can see that it stops. All right, and it stops with this little pointy object right here. All right, see that little pointy object right there? We call that the conus medullaris. That's the distal part of the spinal cord. And then all the way down through the sacrum, you have the vertebral column, but it's not filled with the spinal cord. It's just filled with spinal nerves that are moving away from the spinal cord. And there is a ligament that helps keep the spinal cord in place. We call that the phylum terminale. See the phylum terminale right there? And that grows quickly as somebody is developing, right? When as soon as you're born, you start to grow in length pretty rapidly. And that phylum terminale should grow rapidly as well. But every once in a while, the conus medullaris has an adhesion down to the coccyx. And the spinal cord then gets stretched as a person grows up. And can you imagine what might happen then? It produces very bad neurological deficits, right? It causes damage to the spinal cord, motor deficits, and then surgery has to be performed to release that adhesion, okay? That it has to be, I forget the proper term, it has to be reduced so that, and the spinal cord can go back up, and then that prevents further damage to the spinal cord. All right, all these other spinal nerves that are coming down from the spinal cord through the lumbar region right here, we call, kind of looks like a horse's tail. Otherwise, then, we call that the cauda equina because What does equina mean? It means horse or related to horses, and cauda means tail. Horse's tail right there, all those spinal nerves. Okay. All right, if we look at, also if we look at the spinal cord, let's see, let's look in... The spinal cord looks pretty narrow up over here, and then it looks a lot thicker way down over here. Why do you think that is? You think it'd be thicker all the way up to the brain, but it's thicker down over here. Guess what you have down in that area? You have nerves going to your legs, your lower appendages, and then all the activity that's associated with controlling your legs are in that part of the spinal cord, and that produces an enlargement. So would you guess that there is a corresponding enlargement corresponding to your upper appendages? And you would be correct to assume that. Guess what that's called? All right, that's the cervical enlargement right here. Because there are certain things that happen with your appendages that don't necessarily have to happen with other parts of your body. Okay? Okay. So that's the spinal cord that I want you to be aware of. Quadiquina, fine terminology, the enlargements. Okay, we talked about the different structures of the spinal cord, white matter. All right. Another way of talking about white matter in the spinal cord, since they are either ascending tracts or descending tracts, you could think of them as like being a pencil or a pen or a cable. And it's what? Columnar in nature. So we talk about specific tracts as being columns that either taking information up to the brain or taking information down from the brain to muscles. I think we talked about this already. The columns, posterior, lateral, and anterior columns. I didn't mention that. All right, so in this region right here, right, so here's, can you see the dorsal root ganglia? So this is what, the posterior part of the spinal cord? This is the region that has the posterior columns. So these are tracts that are mostly, what part of the brain, the posterior parts of the brain, is that mostly sensory or motor, posterior? Mostly sensory. So in this part of the spinal cord, you will find mostly afferent tracts or sensory tracts. All right, so this is what we call the posterior columns, or you could call it a funiculus, the posterior funiculus. There are a number of tracts there that are mostly sensory. All right, here's the anterior columns right here, and so sometimes we would call that the anterior funiculus. These are mostly going to be what? Descending or motor. We're going to find exceptions to these rules, or you can find exceptions to these rules. I don't think I'm going to make a big deal out of it, but and then over here are the lateral columns. All right, and don't forget, these are the horns, posterior horn, lateral horn, anterior horn, the gray commissure, and then you see that dot right smack in the middle? There is fluid that fills the internal spaces of the brains. We have cavities inside our brains filled with cerebral spinal fluid. And that cerebral spinal fluid helps nourish the brain, but it also provides for shock absorption and keeps our brain kind of in the right spot. It prevents inflammation due to our brain just moving around inside our cranial vault and spinal cord. And that central canal also has cerebral spinal fluid in it. The cerebral spinal fluid flows all the way down to the conus medullaris. Where is that conus medullaris at? Right here, and then it flows out from the central canal and flows around all of these nerve fibers right here, right? And then it flows back up to the brain on the outside of the spinal cord. And sometimes we need to sample some cerebral spinal fluid because sometimes there is an infection, right? There could be a viral infection or bacterial infection of the cerebral spinal fluid, and that would influence, of course, your brain because it's on the inside of your brain. What do we call that condition?
Meningitis.
That's meningitis. And is that kind of something you can ignore, or is that something that you should be really serious about? really serious, right? Because it could kill you, I suppose, even in a matter of hours if it's not under control. All right, so meningitis is very difficult to diagnose because we need to get some cerebral spinal fluid. And how do we get cerebral spinal fluid? A spinal tap, which means what? I hope you like needles. Nobody likes needles because you need a big needle, right? And we need to put it through the vertebral column, right? And into the space that contains the spinal cord and aspirate, which means suck out some cerebral spinal fluid. And then it's taken to a lab and you culture it and see what's growing in there and test for antibiotic resistance and that kind of stuff. Well, where would you let somebody stick a big needle into your spinal column? Where would be a good place to do that? Lumbar region. Why would you say lumbar region? It's the biggest region right here. But another good reason is you don't have a spinal cord in most of your lumbar region. Where does the spinal cord end? Right here at L2. So anywhere below L2, if somebody jabs you with a needle, you can't damage the spinal cord, right? And when you put a needle in, you might be, and you hit one of these nerves that are in the vertebral column right here, maybe it's just going to get pushed to the side and move out of the way so you don't damage a nerve either, right? So that's a perfect place to do what they call what? You could say a spinal tap, but otherwise it's going to be called what? A lumbar tap as a result, yeah. Your whole central nervous system. And we're going to talk about that. That's one of the last things that we got to talk about for central nervous system. It's not in your spinal cord. It's all connected. And there's flow. There's flow that goes from one part of your central nervous system to another. And I got to tell you about the flow between it as well. So there's places where CSF starts because there are certain parts of the brain that make CSF. And then there are other parts that absorb the cerebral spinal fluid so that it continuously flows through your central nervous system. Okay? And don't make faces like that. It's a wonderful thing. Okay. But, yeah, I probably wouldn't like to go through one of these procedures, so I can understand what you're thinking. Okay. Okay, so sensory and motor pathways in the spinal cord. Anterior tracts are generally what? Motor. And if they're motor, they are what? Ascending or descending? Descending, leaving your brain. And if they're sensory, they're ascending. Some example of these would be the spinal thalamic tract. And remember, in muscles, we learn some nomenclature. So for instance, if I were to say something like, that was a descending tract right there. If I were to say sternocleidomastoid, what could you tell me about the sternocleidomastoid based on nomenclature? Sternum. You're pointing up over here. Sternum is here. Okay. Sternum is here. Wait a second. It's not after spring break yet. I'm worried about you guys Monday after spring break. Okay. But your sternum is right here. Clavicle. Sternocleidomastoid means that muscle originates or inserts into the sternum and clavicle. It, the first part of the word is the origin. The second part is the insertion. So sternum and clavicle is the origin of the sternocleidomastoid. And the insertion is what? The mastoid process. That's the insertion. So that's the part that moves when those muscles contract. All right? So use the same kind of analogy when we name tracts. And you only got to know two tracts in this class. One is the spinal thalamic tract. All right, and so the first part of that word tells us where the signals originate from. The second part tells us where the signals are going to. So where are the signals coming from? The brain? What part of the brain? You're going, well, no, that doesn't make sense. They're coming from the spinal cord. Going to where? Going to the? It's right in the name. Going to the? Into the thalamus, right? So what kind of signal goes from spinal cord to the thalamus? Is that motor or is that sensory? It's got to be a sensory tract. All right, so the spinal thalamic tract is a sensory tract. What about the cortical spinal tract? Corticospinal. Where does signal start? In the cortex, like the cerebral cortex, that's your brain. Where do they end up? Spinal cord. What kind of tract is that? Motor or sensory? That's going to be a motor tract. All right, so those are the two tracts that you have to be aware of. And let's see where I have some pictures of these guys. Ah, probably somewhere here. All right, here's the spinal thalamic tract. All right, so what part of the brain... Oh, I tell you what. So here we have a foot. And let's say, how about... How about some kind of painful stimulus? Like something way too hot, or maybe a pin, or something that's painful. And let's stimulate the bottom of somebody's foot right here. All right, so there's going to be pain receptors in the foot. And the pain receptors send action potentials via the spinal nerve. All right, so here's this. Let me zoom in. So here is the spinal nerve. And what can you tell me about this nerve fiber that you see right here? What kind of nerve fiber does that look like? Oh, don't forget, I think you guys got a test on that Wednesday. That's a what? Unipolar. That's a unipolar neuron. It's a sensory neuron. Enters the spinal cord via the dorsal root. And you can see the dorsal root ganglia right here. It's got thousands of these nerve cell bodies. All right, so that enters the dorsal root where it synapses on the nerve cell body right here of a second order neuron. And that goes all, that crosses over, and it goes all the way up to the brain. Oops. I guess I'm going to have to zoom out. Zoom out. All right, so it goes up to the brain, and let's zoom into this region right here. But before it can go to the cerebral cortex, all right, what has to happen? It's got to stop in the, what is this nucleus right here? This is gray matter deep inside the central nervous system. What nucleus is that? That is the thalamus, because it's a relay station for sensory information. It has to stop here before it can go to the cerebral cortex for appreciation of what kind of stimulus that was. All right, so that was a painful stimulus. So we call this the lateral spinal thalamic tract for painful stimuli. So if somebody has a lesion in this part of the spinal cord, they won't be able to appreciate what kind of sense? They won't be able to appreciate pain. And there are some people that have lesions there. And what is that like? Is that great that you can't experience pain or what? No, it's really not so good, because your body still is damaged. You just can't appreciate it. Right? So if you put your hand down on a Bunsen burner or a stove that's on, you won't feel anything, but what's happening to your hand? It's being destroyed. Right? So pain is still really a good thing, so that you can move your body away from that particular stimulus.
What about you have your arm or your head?
Yeah, if you don't have that lateral spinal thalamic tract, you might be able to smell something burning, but you don't know what it is.
No, I mean, what if your hand feels like without any blood circulation? I know that that happens
not
sure, but does that have anything to do with
it? Oh, it has a different pharmacological reason. But yeah, if you ever lose pain sensation in some part of your body, maybe because you cut off circulation or anesthesia or whatever, you have to be very careful. Like, who's been to the dentist and had anesthesia on maybe a trigeminal nerve to where you don't feel pain sensation inside your mouth? That's great when the dentist is working on you, but that wouldn't be great over dinner. Because why? You couldn't tell if you're chewing your tongue up. Right? So pain is a very important kind of sense. Right, and you have to be very careful if you don't have proper pain sensation. All right, cortical spinal tract. Where's the cortical spinal tract? Oops. Okay, here it is right here. So cortical spinal means what? Sensory or motor? It's going to be motor. Where do motor signals originate from? The cortex, and in particular, what, the precentral gyrus, So here are signals coming from the precentral gyrus, and you can see them going through this white matter right here is what we call the internal capsule of the brain. There are no synapses in the thalamus, and then it descends down the spinal cord, okay? And then eventually it leaves. How does it leave? Look at the nerve cell body in the anterior horn, the gray matter of the spinal cord. And then this is a motor neuron that goes to a skeletal muscle that's going to cause the skeletal muscle to contract. All right, so these neurons coming down from the brain, sometimes we call these upper motor neurons. And these that are leaving the spinal cord, these sometimes are what we call the lower motor neurons. And you can see where that lower motor neuron originates from, right here in the ventral horn of the gray matter. And then what root does it leave, the spinal cord?
The ventral root,
because the ventral root is 100% motor. Can't leave the dorsal root, because dorsal root is 100% sensory. Yeah. Okay. Reflexes. Reflexes are important because they're very, very fast. They protect our body from damaging stimuli, temperature, pain, cutting, or whatever. And here is the reflex arc. Reflexes are very fast because they include only some very low levels of your central nervous system. They don't include your brain. So where do you have the appreciation of the world that you live in? What part of your nervous system? Do you have consciousness? Where do you really appreciate things around you? That's your cerebral cortex. That's your cerebral cortex, the gray matter of your cerebral hemispheres, right? Not your spinal cord. So you can make conscious decisions of information that you have in your cerebral cortex, but your spinal cord can actually make decisions for you at the level of the spinal cord. So a painful stimulus comes into your spinal cord, the spinal cord already knows how to protect your body before you even know your body is being damaged. And that's what we call a reflex.
So you're saying that the spinal cord has the consciousness of itself?
No, it has awareness of various parts of your body, which is not necessarily shared at the same instant that you actually perceive that reality. So it happens, you start to protect your body before you're even aware that some part of your body is being damaged.
So in the case of pain, it detects more quickly pain than the brain itself?
It detects pain first and makes a decision on what to do with that pain. That pain signal goes to your brain via what? The lateral spinal thalamic tract. And then it reaches your awareness, and then you might make additional judgments of what to do with that pain information. Okay, like for instance, if you put your hand on something hot, your spinal cord is going to tell your hand to move away from that, right, from that stimulus. But when that pain information reaches your brain, okay, what might your brain make a decision to do? Yeah, even move the rest of your body away or turn the stove off, or if somebody is doing something to you, it might tell your other hand to punch that person, okay? That's not something that your spinal cord can make a decision on. That's something that your brain would make a decision about.
Is that the reason why we sometimes feel the pain like a little bit delayed?
Yes, you always feel the pain delayed compared to when your spinal cord does, even after you move. So you're going to move away from the pain and then have the perception of it. That's because of reflexes. So let's dissect what a reflex is and take a look and see where it is in your body. Okay? All right, so here are... there's a couple things that I left off from this list. I should modify this list. All right, but here are the anatomical features of a reflex arc. And the first thing right here, what I should have right here, is a stimulus. So a reflex arc always starts with a stimulus. A reflex will never start by itself. There's got to be a reason why a reflex starts, and that's a stimulus. And in order for you to appreciate a stimulus, what do you have to have for any kind of stimulus? Like if it's a light stimulus, what do you need? You need a receptor, right? So for instance, if you have no retina, if somebody shines a flashlight in your face, you're not going to see that particular stimulus, right? So you need receptors for that. Or if you don't have receptors in your ears. Somebody could talk to you all day long, but you're not going to hear a thing, right? So you need the proper receptor. All right, so a stimulus will be appreciated by a sensor. That sensor will start electrical activity and share it with the brain, but that electrical activity has to get into the brain. How does it get into the brain? Via a sensory neuron. What kind of neurons typically are sensory neurons? Are unipolar? Unipolar neurons. All right, and how does a unipolar neuron get into this, into the central nervous system? Via the, it says right there, dorsal root. Right? It's going to pass by the dorsal root ganglia, get into your central nervous system, and then in the spinal cord, there is going to be a neuron called an interneuron or an association neuron that receives that electrical information, and that neuron decides what to do. It's going to share that information, and probably if it's a harmful stimulus, that interneuron is going to say contract some muscles to get out of the way of that harmful stimulus. So an interneuron is going to stimulate what kind of neuron in order for you to contract the muscle to get out of the way? A motor neuron, right? So motor neurons tell skeletal muscles to contract. And how do motor neurons leave the central nervous system? Through the ventral root, right? And then that motor neuron takes the information to an effector organ. A good effector organ we were talking about is what, a skeletal muscle. And when electrical signals reach a skeletal muscle, what does that skeletal muscle do? It always contracts. Skeletal muscle can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. It just contracts. And that's what we call a response. So that's how I would like for you to modify this reflex arc right here, is that it always starts with a, you should write this in, it starts with a stimulus and it ends with a response. Right? So that's the whole reflex arc right there. Are you talking about that? Ah, sign in sheet. Dang. Pass. Sign it fast. Find your name fast because we're running out of time. Yeah.
What happens when you twitch? How does that start?
Oh, involuntary twitch?
Yeah.
Okay. It could be due to a couple of things. Maybe a little bit of a damage to a muscle. Maybe you were exercising or something and overworked the muscle. It could also be due to an imbalance in some chemicals that provide for electricity in our body. Like what kind of chemicals give our body electrical properties? Like sodium and potassium, because those are electrolytes. Maybe there's a little imbalance in electrolytes. But probably very common is that there's a pharmacologic reason, like too much caffeine. Okay, for instance, I don't know if you drink tea or coffee or whatever, but usually muscle twitches are prompted by some of those things, or combinations of those kinds of things. Could be not lack of caffeine, lack of electrolytes, but too much caffeine. Okay, because sometimes somebody's eye might twitch, or you might have a little muscle in your ear that twitches, and you're going to hear a thump, 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 that kind of thing. Or you might have a twitch in your arm or your leg or something like that. Cramp, yeah, that same thing. Okay, but that's usually more to some kind of metabolic thing. All right, so what does a reflex arc look like?
What was that baby?
Okay. Okay, what is it at a hemangioma? Reflex, maybe I don't have it in this chapter. Reflex arc. I guess it might be the next chapter. Chapter 12. Okay, well, you might have to know something about the reflex arc for the test. Maybe I should go and find that picture. That's one of your pictures. Maybe I should go find that picture roll. So that's going to be chapter 12. There's a reflex arc. We got probably a couple pictures of reflex arcs. Is that one right there? Here. Okay, so here are a couple reflex arcs. Monosynaptic versus polysynaptic. Let's look at the polysynaptic reflex. Okay, so what's the first step in a reflex arc? Is a, and here's attack. What kind of stimulus? Painful stimulus. In order for you to feel that pain, you need a receptor, a pain receptor. The kind of receptors that are pain receptors typically are free nerve endings that gets stimulated. And how does that information get to your central nervous system? The receptor sends information through the sensory neuron, right? And here it's going to enter the spinal cord via which root? The dorsal root, and you can see it passing by the dorsal root ganglia. There's a cell body for this neuron right here because it's a bipolar neuron. It enters, and then it's going to synapse on an interneuron, or you could call that an association neuron. That association neuron then knows what to do with that information. The first thing that it's going to do is share the information with this lower motor neuron right here. Here's the cell body in the ventral horn, and it leaves the ventral root because that's 100% motor. So here's a motor neuron that goes to a skeletal muscle, causing that skeletal muscle to contract and withdraw your hand from that painful stimulus. All right, so I see three neurons in this diagram. Two are multipolar. Which two are multipolar? The interneuron is, and the motor neuron is, and then I also see a unipolar neuron, which is the sensory neuron right here. Alright, so that's what the first step of the first job of this interneuron is, to stimulate this motor neuron to withdraw your body from that painful stimulus. But this interneuron might also share information with neurons that go up to your brain so that you can feel that tack. Alright, via what? The lateral spinal thalamic tract, for instance, so that you can appreciate that event. Alright, so what kind of neurons do we see partly in the peripheral nervous system and partly in the central nervous system? Okay. Well, neurons can only be one way. They can either be sensory or motor. Nerves, on the other hand, can be mixed, but a nerve fiber can only be one or the other. It can't be both. So, I don't know. Let me ask that again. What neurons do you see on this diagram right here that are, depending on their location, sometimes in the peripheral nervous system and sometimes in the central nervous system? It is the? Okay. It's the motor neuron. Motor neuron is partly in the peripheral nervous system here, but where's the cell body? Central nervous system. What about the sensory neuron? It's partly in the peripheral nervous system because this is the peripheral process of that unipolar neuron. But where does it go? Into the central nervous system. That's why we call that the central process of that unipolar neuron. All right. So both the motor and sensory neuron are located where? Partly in the peripheral and partly in the central nervous system. All right, now is there, you see a neuron that is completely within the peripheral nervous system at all? I mean, that's the only place where you find it. I don't see it there. There aren't any, okay, at least in this diagram right here. Now, you see a neuron that is contained completely within the central nervous system. Yeah, that association neuron or interneuron is completely within the CNS. All right, so you should see that level of detail. Right, the interneuron is completely within the central nervous system. That's what an association neuron is. It's something that shares information within what? The central processing units of the central nervous system. Okay, so that's a reflex. Starts with a stimulus. Receptor picks up the stimulus, sends it in a sensory neuron. That sensory neuron shares information with the interneuron. Interneuron makes a decision on what to do with the information. Shares it with a motor neuron, takes it to an effector organ, and what does the effector organ produce? It always produces a response. So that's the steps of a reflex arc. Okay. All right, well, we had a lot of questions about cerebral spinal fluid and the different chambers of the brain and the membranes around the brain. All right, so let me go back to here. Let's get back to the central nervous system. Okay, I think I'm going to talk about the meninges first of the brain. All right, so here we see a cross-section of the brain. All right, so what does this look like here? Where I'm pointing with a cursor? That's gray matter, nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and then these are all? Yeah, white matter. These are tracts, right? Association tracts, commissural tracts. Yeah? The gray matter is anywhere on the surface of the brain. It's not on the inside. The inside is mostly tracts. There's only a few areas that contain nuclei, like the basal nuclei. Okay, the thalamus can share information, but most of your processing power is in the cerebral cortex. So for that reason, you don't want to damage the cerebral cortex, but you don't want to damage deeper parts of the brain either, because that's how information gets transmitted from one part of your brain to the other, from one part of your body to another. All right, so both are necessary. Oh, I can't quite hear you. In surgery?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what they need to do. I don't know, maybe you see me after class, okay? If it's an aneurysm or a tumor, or if they're trying to develop a strategy to defeat epilepsy or something, the surgery is all different depending on the circumstances, okay? Okay, so the brain is very soft. Does the brain have any bones in it? Did you learn any bones? No, like a banana, right? Bananas don't have any bones. So there has to be something that protects the brain. And it is the cerebral spinal fluid that the brain is surrounded and also is on the inside of. But there are some membranes, very tough membranes, that hold the brain in position. And those membranes we call the meninges. And when you did your brain dissection, you probably ran into one that was really difficult to dissect. Anybody remember dissecting a sheep brain yet? No, not yet? There's one membrane that's very, very tough. And that's the durable membrane, and otherwise it's called the dura mater, right? The durable matter of the brain. It's like shoe leather. As a matter of fact, it might even be tougher to cut than shoe leather. It contains a lot of collagen. And okay, then there are a couple other layers. So let's take a look at these different layers right here of the brain. All right, so let's start with the brain matter itself. So you got white matter, which is deep, gray matter, which is superficial, and then there's a membrane right on the surface of the brain, and every little invagination is covered with this membrane. So what do we call that? The membrane covering the outer surface of a bone. What did we call that? The periosteum. Periosteum, right? So this you might think of as like the periosteum of a brain, but it's very difficult. Right? This is what we call the pia mater. Right? P-I-A-M-A-T-E-R. Pia mater. So the labels are off the screen, but you should be able to see the pia mater in your book. This might be an exam figure, I would guess. All right, maybe you printed that out, okay? All right, and then there's a space right here. This space, we can see some connective tissue in it. In this space, it contains blood vessels, so it's bringing blood to various parts of the brain. But the space contains primarily cerebral spinal fluid. And it's going to flow through this space between the pia mater and the next membrane, which is right here. This is what we call the arachnoid. So that's the second of the three membranes that make up the meninges. So this space, guess what we call this space that contains CSF? That's the subarachnoid space, because it's the space right below the arachnoid membrane. All right, and then the next layer is this one and this one together. This is the dura mater. This is the membrane that's very, very, very tough. And this is the one that's connected to various parts of your cranium. Like, where could you think that the dura mater connects to? There's something that sticks way up into the brain that the dura mater attaches to. So that when you turn your head, your brain doesn't slosh around in there. That is the part of the ethmoid bone. I like it. The crista galli, right? That shark fin that's sticking up there. Right, that's a major anchoring point for the dura mater, right, that holds your brain in place. So here is the dura mater. All right, so what are these three layers? Let's start with the superficial one. You got the dura mater, and then the arachnoid, and then the pia mater. And between the pia and the arachnoid is the subarachnoid space. And what do you got in that subarachnoid space? Cerebrospinal fluid. Yeah, CSF. What? The spider web. It's like a spider web. That's just connective tissue, right? That's connecting between the arachnoid and the pia mater right here. So you know, I don't think you have to know the name. Those would be like Sharpie's fibers that you would see in bone. It's just connective tissue fibers, and fluid can flow around them very, very easily. Okay. Now the last thing I want you to remember is this little. You see this little bulge. The arachnoid pokes up through the dura mater and into this sinus right here. And a sinus is a little funny because it has different names. It can contain different things depending on where it is. So the paranasal sinuses, what's inside your paranasal sinuses? It's just air. This sinus right here contains blood. So this is how blood drains from your brain back to your heart into the venous system. And this is the superior sagittal sinus. And this right here, this arachnoid granulation or an arachnoid villus, is a way for cerebrospinal fluid to leave the brain and go back into the circulatory system. All right, so if these things are blocked, then cerebrospinal fluid will build up in the brain. And what does that produce? That was that picture you were very interested in.
Oh, the baby.
Yeah, the baby. Okay, we're going to look at some other chambers and passageways inside the brain for cerebral spinal fluid a week from today, right after the test, and we'll talk about hydrocephalus even at that point in time. All right, so there's just a couple more things I got to finish up with central nervous system. Okay, but don't forget the sign-in. Where's the sign-in sheet? I think it's in the back row right now. Yeah.
The one that's the gal, the actress that had the injury.
Oh, just recently. Richardson?
Yeah,